KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the journalist Paul Tough wrote a book about the skills young people need to succeed. He went through the research and he identified these traits, these qualities like perseverance and self-control and grit. Grit was a big one. But when he would talk about the book, he often got a version of this question. Okay, so those are the skills. Now what do we do? That is, how do you pass on these skills? How do you teach them? Well, Tough has learned that you don't really teach them, not in the conventional way. It just doesn't work with disadvantaged kids. So he's written a new book that explores the practical things teachers and parents and policymakers can do to improve a kid's chances. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about it. The place you start, he says, is with a person's environment. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West's podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, providing wealth management to the Intermountain West for over 30 years. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For more than a decade, the journalist Paul Tough has been exploring how children succeed. That was actually the name of his last book. He pays particular attention to disadvantaged kids, those who come from poverty, for example. And he wanted to know, for those kids who do make it, what are the personal traits they carry with them? So he went through the research and he identified this set of skills, things like optimism and self-control and resilience and grit. Grit was the one that many of us keyed on. And it was a fascinating book, but Tough says after he finished it, he was left with this question: exactly how do you pass along these skills? Because he started to realize the conventional teaching paradigm might not work. As he puts it in his latest book, maybe you can't teach character in the way you teach math. And in fact, he found the teachers who seemed to have figured this out didn't actually teach these skills. They didn't even use the words grit or resilience, but somehow they had found a way to convey these ideas in their own behavior and their own example. In other words, Tough learned this was about the environment as much as any lesson or model. Paul Tough is back with us today. His new book is called Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. Paul Tough is a regular contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, a regular contributor to This American Life. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Paul Tough, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So you've been doing this for more than a decade now, exploring these particular issues. Remind us, what is it that got you started thinking about all of this?
For me, it started with the reporting that went into my first book, Whatever It Takes, which is about an organization called the Harlem Children's Zone and the man, Jeffrey Canada, who started it and ran it for many years. It was 13 years ago that I first met Jeff and started reporting on him. And that experience, it took me 5 years to write that book and to report that book. And that experience of being in Harlem, watching him work with the kids he was trying to help, both was really influential on me in terms of my being impressed with his methods and his ideas, but it also really stirred a lot of questions in me, questions about what is going on in childhood, how are kids developing the skills or not that they need to succeed, and why are these gaps so persistent between how well-off kids and low-income kids are doing, and what can we do to narrow those gaps?
You point out that more than half the public school kids students in this country are falling below now the poverty line. And so you say teaching these kids is this is the central issue in American education. Say something about that, because you call the system profoundly broken right now.
Sure. So just to clarify, they're not actually necessarily falling below the poverty line, but being eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And you can get that eligibility up to about 180% of the poverty line. So it includes some, sort of lower working class families as well. But this was research that I wasn't aware of at all before I started working on helping children succeed. Just how much this number has gone up, that in the 1980s, about a third of all public school students were eligible for a free or reduced price lunch. And then in 2013, it finally passed the halfway mark. So in some ways, that's just a symbol, but it is, I think, an important symbol at the very least. I think for those of us who are not living in high poverty communities, we can often think that the problems in education of low income kids are something off to the side. You know, there's like mainstream educational mm-hmm. questions, and then there's this other little question about kids and disadvantage. And that number suggests to me that actually this is the reality, the main reality in our public schools today. And so it is no longer something that we can just say, well, certain teachers are going to solve. It's something that all of us have to solve.
So the new book, the idea for the new book, I mean, you've written about these so-called non-cognitive skills, which we'll sort of refresh our memories about here in a moment. But you say that when you would talk about this before, that people kept asking you, okay, great. So these are these skills. Now what do we do?
Right.
And so what did you want to do with this book? I mean, because it's a very practical kind of a guide is almost the way to look at it. Is that fair to say?
It is. That's certainly my goal, is to write something much more practical. So, you know, I, as a writer, I'm in the sort of narrative nonfiction tradition. In the past, what I've done is gone and you know, written about characters, drawn scenes, and try to use that to get ideas across. And I think there's something very powerful about that writing tradition. But it also, I think, doesn't provide really clear answers to people who need this information more practically. And so that's what I was hearing from teachers, educators, you know, pediatricians, mentors, all kinds of readers who were working directly with children in disadvantage. They wanted to know, like, okay, what do we do? Like, this research is interesting. It resonates. The idea that there are these other skills makes sense, but we don't know what to do. And I realized not only had I not answered that question in my book, but that a lot of the researchers who I was writing about, who were most concerned with character and non-cognitive skills, they didn't have a lot of clear answers either. They were still working toward figuring them out. And so that pushed me with this new book to go, first of all, to go back and revisit some of the research and reporting that I'd done before, but also to try to expand it into new directions where there, I thought, were more clear ideas about what we all can do to change things for students.
Hmm. One more approach that you've taken, and I think it's worth mentioning, at least early on, you say that rather than fragment childhood into these sections, which is what we tend to do, you're looking at childhood as a continuum, as you say in the book, a single unbroken story. Explain the distinction there, why that's important for you.
Sure. I think some of this influence, you know, I was talking about the Harlem Children's Zone in that early reporting that I did. I think some of the influence that stuck with me from that was that Jeffrey Canada's program is this continuum, you know, this pipeline that where his programs start before birth and continue up to kids going off to college. And that is how, you know, children experience childhood. It's how families experience childhood. But it's not the way that our bureaucracies deal with childhood. There are all sorts of divisions. The biggest one being, you know, from the federal education department on down to, you know, individual school boards, what we do to help children develop in the first few years of life is the responsibility in Washington of the Department of Health and Human Services. And then suddenly on your first day of kindergarten, your file is handed over to the Federal Department of Education, right. And that's who's responsible for you. And that I think, is symbolic of this way that we think of early childhood as this sort of other realm. And so I think that's the big division between early childhood and K-12 education. But I think it continues as well, these divisions between school and home, after school, mm-hmm. and what's happening in the classroom. It's just not the way that children are experiencing their childhood. And if we want to help them succeed in a broader, more comprehensive way, we need to think more broadly and more comprehensively.
Here's another thing I wanted to ask you about before we dig in. You mentioned that there are these limitations to the way journalists have been covering this issue in the past. They look for these programs that work, and then they try to sort of replicate them or scale them up, as you put it. But you say scaling up may not work so well. And the premise for your book, the premises here is that no program or school is perfect. So explain what you mean there. The idea is you can't find some unifying theory, some grand model. You have to go small and you have to go individual. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, so for me, a lot of the impulse behind that new approach in this new book came, again, from the Harlem Children's Zone. And so right at the moment that Whatever It Takes came out in 2008 was this moment where Senator Obama then, in his first election campaign, had proposed that if he was president, he was going to replicate the Harlem Children's Zone in cities all over the country. And that was pretty exciting to me as someone who had just spent 5 years reporting on this organization and was about to come out with a book about it. And in fact, he kind of did. So there is this program called Promise Neighborhoods that's been in place in the Education Department for the entire Obama administration. And it is just, much smaller and less ambitious and more bureaucratic than it was intended or than Senator Obama described it. And it has not been super effective in replicating the Harlem Children's Zone. I still think there should be Harlem Children's Zones in cities all over the country. But I've come to more question certainly my role as as no longer being sort of, finding the perfect program and saying, have these everywhere. And instead trying to look at lots of different programs and saying, these are all interesting, important. None of them are perfect. Mm-hmm. But what can we learn from what's working in this program and what's working in that program down the street and this program in, a couple towns over that might give us some principles that could guide anyone who is running a school, managing a classroom, running a preschool or just, existing in a family mm-hmm. that might help us do things differently.
Well, let's go to this idea of character that we've talked about this before. The character strengths that are really key to success for young people, particularly low-income kids. So let's refresh ourselves with some of these concepts. This is the idea that you wrote about in the last book, that character matters. These are these non-cognitive skills. They're personal qualities. Go through some of these for us, if you would. This idea of grit, of course, comes to mind. It's the best word of them all. But,
sure. So,
resilience, all those things, yeah.
Yeah. So I want to just preface that by saying that the part of, I think, what has changed in my mind since my last book, How Children Succeed, came out, is that I no longer feel that sort of thinking of these as like this constellation of specific skills is the most helpful approach, that instead thinking of this as this whole realm of kind of psychology and motivation and non-cognitive ability is more useful. But that said, some of the words I think that often come up in with people who are studying this and trying to educators who are trying to help kids develop in this non-cognitive realm. Perseverance, I think, is a big one, especially persevering through difficulties, bouncing back from setbacks, resilience, grit being related to perseverance, but also having this element of sort of long-term passion for something, curiosity, optimism, self-control, and all of the sort of self-regulatory skills that go along with self-control. And conscientiousness is another one that is something of a synonym for some of these skills, perhaps, but is a category that some psychologists have especially studied.
One of the things that you found is this kind of paradox, and I mentioned this in the introduction, that some of the teachers, I'm thinking of Lenita Reed, for example, who's not really even a conventional teacher, but who do this right, who seem to have figured this out, they don't, quote unquote, teach the principle of grit. Like, they don't even use the word grit. It's conveyed in a different way. Would you talk about that?
Sure. So, and again, a lot of the impetus for this book was the experience of kind of looking back on my reporting for How Children Succeed and noticing that I'd been doing two things. One is I'd been going to some schools, especially the Kipp schools and the Riverdale school, where they were taking this very, sort of straightforward teaching approach, trying to do what I think a lot of educators do when they are exposed to this research about the importance of the non-cognitive realm. You look at it like a teacher. You say, okay, if there are skills that I need my kids to develop, I'm gonna teach them. And so that means I need to be able to define them and label them and assess them and create tests for them and create curricula and pedagogies that are going to help develop them. And then at the same time, I was reporting on other teachers and mentors and pediatricians who were taking a very different approach. And so Lenita Reed was this hairdresser, actually. She owned her own salon on the south side of Chicago. And she was working at the same time for this organization called YAP, that was this mentoring program on the south side that was working with some of the most disadvantaged, most at-risk teenagers on the south side. And so she had been assigned to this one young woman named Keitha, who had had a tremendously difficult life up to that point. But she had had this really transformative effect on Keitha's life and had, Keitha was this kid who just came to school ready to fight every day and was constantly on the verge of being suspended or expelled. And Lenita was able to really change her way of thinking and change her motivation, change her behavior and her approach to school. And she did it not by like giving her lectures or, you know, curiosity homework or grit, you know, sort of some sort of grit pedagogy, but with just talk to her and made her feel a sense of support and belonging and empathy. That for a kid like Keitha was exactly what she needed. You know, she was a very unhappy, depressed, anxious, angry person, understandably so, given what she had faced. And so that kind of connection from Lenita really changed things for her. And so that made me think, well, okay, maybe we're saying there's this thing called grit. This girl, Keitha, seems like she has more grit. She's persevering more in school. But is what has happened really that she has learned a skill? Mm-hmm. That's not what it looked like to me. What it looked like to me is that something had changed in her environment, mostly through her relationship with Lenita Reed. And as a result, she had changed her psychology, and that had changed her behavior, and that had changed her success in school. And that paradigm, in some ways, not totally different than a teaching paradigm, but I think significantly different. And it pointed to me pointed me toward this idea that there might be a whole different way to think about this non-cognitive realm and what we can do as individuals and as a society in homes and in schools to make kids help kids go through the kind of transformation that Keitha had gone through from feeling very unmotivated, disconnected, to feeling motivated and connected.
It seems like this is one of those things that it would be difficult to quantify in some ways. It's easy to teach a thing, a model. You have a sort of a thing. But how do you say to teachers, be more tender, be more right. attentive? You know, that seems to be one of the obstacles that I think teachers and policymakers are going to have to deal with. How do you convey these kind of abstract things?
Well, so I would say I would agree with half of what you said. I actually don't think that it's hard to give teachers training and professional development and support that says, yeah, be more empathetic. Think about how you're creating a climate in the classroom. So there are, in fact, a couple of experiments that I read about in the book where instructional coaches did exactly that, worked with teachers in a very kind of supportive way. Understanding that the job of teaching is really hard in general, and especially when you're teaching kids who are growing up in difficult circumstances, who are stressed out, it's even more difficult. But you know, with relatively minor levels of professional development and support, ongoing coaching that happens once a week over the course of a semester. The teacher's behavior can really change. Their approach changes, and these research studies show that changes things for the kids in their class. Mm-hmm. Where I absolutely do agree with you is that the natural sort of education bureaucrats' instinct to measure these things, right. To say, well, let's figure out which teachers are being more tender and empathetic and give their classroom a tenderness and empathy rating out of 10
right.
And hold them accountable for the tenderness and empathy in their classroom. I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that all of the sort of accountability and measurement approach that we have used makes a lot of sense in this realm. I don't think that means that we just sort of throw up our hands and say, well, teachers figure it out and good luck, and we can't tell what's good and what's not good. But I do think that the kind of rigorous, data-based, give everybody a test approach that has dominated education for the past decade is the right approach in general, and especially for these qualities.
Paul Tough is with us. His book is Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Paul Tough is back with us talking about how it is you help children succeed. For a number of years now, 13 in fact, he's been exploring the question. And one of the things that he's discovered and wrote about in his last book are these personal traits that are really important if a kid is going to make it, like resilience and self-control. His new book, though, explains how you put all of that into practice. It's called Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. I want to take a call from Felicia because I think she has a good question. Calling from Salt Lake City. Felicia, welcome.
Hi, Mr. Tuff. Love both books. Can't wait to read the new one. I was wondering, you were talking about a teacher just a few moments ago that worked with kind of the lowest of the low, some of the most challenging students that teachers work with. And I wondered what your research suggested about that group that's just slightly above them. So maybe mid to low class or economic status. That is the largest group that we have. I'm an educator in our classroom, and I wondered what your research suggested about them. Thank you.
Thanks, Felicia, for that question. So I think that those are the students who are sort of at the who are the main target of this research. I do think that tremendous educators and mentors like Lenita are able to make a difference with kids like Keitha. But I think the reality is that is hard to systematize. It really takes a very spontaneous kind of approach to find the right connection to help kids change. But I think the number that we talked about, the 51% of public school students now in the United States are eligible for a free or reduced price lunch, are low income. What that means is that there is this really big population that is maybe not, in the intense kind of need that Keitha has, but are still faced with all kinds of struggles at home. And need additional levels of support in school. And so to me, this approach of thinking about their environment, both in their home and in the classroom, is specifically targeted to try to help those kids succeed.
Felicia, thanks for the call. Let's talk about stress, because it seems like this is such a crucial part of this story. We all have a stress response network, you say. Mm-hmm. But for kids, the system seems like it's super sensitive to these environmental cues. Talk about toxic stress and the role that it plays in the story.
Sure. So this whole field of stress neurobiology is something that I wasn't aware of until I started this reporting. And it doesn't seem at first glance like it's something that's deeply connected to what's happening in classrooms. But the more that research develops, the more persuaded I am that it's central to understanding what's happening with students in school, and especially with low-income kids. So yes, we all have within us this developing stress response system, and especially in the early days and weeks and months and years of life, it acts as a kind of adversity thermostat. It looks around kids for clues to what life is going to be like, and it adapts accordingly. So when it gets the message through lots of stress, through lots of adversity, that life is going to be hard, that life is going to be full of trouble, it reacts by creating actual sort of biological changes in kids. It increases their our immune system. It amps up our production of adrenaline and cortisol and other stress hormones. It fires up our fight or flight response and puts us on a hair trigger that sometimes lasts our entire life. And what these researchers now understand is that these physical and psychological and mental effects can persist over a lifetime. I talk about this study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences mm-hmm. Study that finds long-term health effects of childhood adversity. It increases the cancer rate and the heart disease rate and the emphysema rate for adults who've experienced lots of trauma as kids. But it also, I think, we're now coming to understand better the effect that it has on our mental and psychological development and the role that plays in school.
Well, also, if your ACE score, that's the Adverse Childhood Experience sort of acronym, if you have a high score, you have higher rates of depression and anxiety and suicide. You're more likely to smoke and be alcoholic and engage in sex at a young age. I mean, that correlation is fascinating.
Yeah, and I think what we now understand is that the mechanism behind that is this stress response system. So all of that instability and trauma and stress that some kids are experiencing way too much of in early childhood, it affects our development on, on these really basic levels. And so, you know, all of the different symptoms that you're describing, those are the effects. You know, it makes us, it makes it harder to calm down, harder to, you know, feel good about ourselves, harder to get along with others, all of these things that, you know, that, that then have effects on not only our physical health, but on our mental health.
You really focus on the environment in the book, and two places in particular, school and home. Let's start with home at first, because neglect is something that you write about. And this turns out to be, you say, one of the most serious threats to a young person's development. And say something about what you write about a parent's interaction with the children, this idea of serve and return interactions, I thought was really interesting.
Great. Yeah, I found that research fascinating as well. So one of the things about the adverse childhood experience score is that it is something of a blunt instrument. It sort of equates all of these experiences that kids can have in early childhood, and you get 1 point for each category of bad things that happens to you in childhood. And what researchers are now subsequently coming to understand is that we can make interesting distinctions between what the effect of different kinds of trauma and stress are. And one of the ones that was surprising to me was how significant neglect can be. So to me, I feel like abuse is so clear in my mind of why and how that can be damaging to kids. But neglect, just kind of like ignoring kids, not responding to them, not connecting with them, when that is done in an intense and long-term way, what psychologists call chronic understimulation, that can have effects on children's brain development that are as acute as abuse can have. Even if there's no physical abuse, no neglect on the level of, you know, sort of medical neglect, if kids are getting, you know, enough food and shelter and everything else, if they don't have a warm, connected, compassionate, responsive relationship with a parent or another caregiver, it changes the way that they develop. And what the researchers have found is that one of the most profound parts of a close, connected, secure relationship is this serve and return parenting, which is just the kind of back and forth playing that parents do with infants all the time, where an infant, you know, makes some noise or indicates something or even looks in a certain direction. That's the serve. And then a parent does what most parents always do, which is say, "Oh, you're looking at your doggy," or "Yeah, you see the fan," or you know, "Oh, you're dancing," you know. Those little ridiculous exchanges that we have with babies, they mean a whole lot to those infants. You know, what infants' brains are trying to do in early childhood is make sense of the world, and the biggest part of that world for them is their relationship with their parents or caregivers. And it's these server return interactions that are their way of learning. And so when those are positive, when those are happening a lot, when they're happening in a warm and connected way, it again sends these messages to the stress response system that, you know, life is going to be fine, that you can relax and take it easy, that you can trust the adults in your life. They're there to support you, that it's okay to be curious about the world, that it's full of positive surprises of all kinds. And all of those messages create adaptations in children's brains that make it easier for them to succeed in school on the first day of kindergarten. They're more able to concentrate for long periods of time. They're more able to get along with peers and follow directions. They can manage stressful situations in ways that kids who haven't had that experience, who have gotten a different set of messages from being abused or neglected or otherwise experiencing lots of stress, than the messages that those kids have received.
There's a really interesting study that you write about from St. Petersburg in Russia in the early 2000s.
Yes.
And these kids were being taken care of. Like, they had enough to eat. You know, their basic needs were being serviced, but the staff didn't interact with them. There was no serve and return going on in those circumstances. So what did that kind of neglect do to those young people?
It was really profound. Yeah, so this is an orphanage in St. Petersburg. And simply not having that kind of face-to-face responsive interaction profoundly affected the development of these kids. They were, their growth was stunted. Their behavior was crazy. They were often entirely withdrawn. Mm-hmm. You know, the kinds of things you'd expect to see with kids who had been horribly abused or maltreated. But no one was abusing them. No one was maltreating them. They just weren't getting a lot of love and connection and back and forth interaction. And what is most profound and important, I think, about this study is that then this group of researchers came in and gave the adults who were working in this orphanage some pretty basic training, just saying like, hey, when you're feeding these kids and changing their diapers and playing with them and bathing them, just like act a little bit more like parents, you know, and sing to them and smile at them and make jokes and do peekaboo and play with them and see what happens. And what happened was that these kids' lives were profoundly changed. They in all sorts of, you know, very specific measurable ways. Their height and weight and chest circumference improved. Their behavior improved. Their mental health improved. And what I like best about this study is so did the mental health of the workers in the orphanage. They felt better as well because the kids felt better.
How important are those first 3 years, Paul Tough?
They're very important. They're very important. I mean, they're important in all sorts of ways, the early years. But I think the thing we're now coming to understand is that they are especially important in this non-cognitive dimension, right. that these are the years when children's stress response system and thus kind of their psychology is being formed. And it's being formed, you know, not through flashcards and vocabulary sheets. It's being formed just through their interactions and their relationships with other people and mostly with the adults in their lives. And so I think we've known for a long time that early childhood is important, but I think we have mostly been thinking about it, certainly in our policy, as a time where kids are supposed to be learning the sort of precursors of their academic skills, where we got to do a better job of getting them training in letters and numbers. And there's a case to be made for that we can do more in terms of helping kids develop in that realm. But the big place where we've got a gap is in their development on this non-cognitive dimension. And that is all about their back and forth interaction with the adults in their lives. And we're not doing enough, especially in low-income homes and low-income communities, of working with those parents and supporting those parents to try to improve the environment in those children's homes.
It's an issue of resources that you write about. I mean, how much, when you compare the amount of money, let's say public money or governmental money that's going to that arc of childhood, how much of that is being targeted to those first important years? It seems like that's sort of out of balance in some way, do you think?
Absolutely. So this was a number that I wasn't aware of until doing this reporting. But right now, 94% of the public money that we spend helping kids in early childhood goes after the third birthday. It goes to 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. And only 6% goes for those first important 3 years from 0 to 3. And I should add, this is within a pie of money that is already much smaller than is true in other countries. We spend less on early childhood as a whole than almost every other developed country in the world relative to what we spend on childhood on sort of 0 to 18. So we don't spend enough on 0 to 6. And then within that 0 to 6, we really don't spend enough on 0 to 3. And this is all happening at the same time that we're discovering the profound importance of those years in the development of these important skills in children.
If let's say there isn't a proper serve and return interaction for young people, you know, and so that hasn't been able to have an effect on the sort of, the plastic part of their brain, can you rebuild those connections later on if it didn't happen in those regions of the brain early on? I mean, can you later repair that, fix that? Do you know what I mean?
I do. And the answer is yes, absolutely. And so I just want to step back a bit to say that, you know, I think there is this I get a little bit anxious talking about the research about early childhood because I do think it is so profound what is happening on this neurological level that it can – there's a risk that it can make us feel, you know, complacent or fatalistic. Just this idea that like, okay, that kid didn't get serve and return in the first few years.
Yeah.
He's a write-off.
Right,
let's not devote any more resources to that child. And in fact, we should be doing the opposite, right? We should, if that kid arrives in kindergarten without having had the kind of early childhood experiences that we would want for him, he needs more help, right? And there is a whole lot that we can do, beginning in, you know, pre-K and kindergarten, but continuing on through throughout K-12 education. The problem is that in most school settings right now, we're not doing that. You know, most of the work that is happening in K-12 education is not really informed by this growing body of research on what growing up in adversity does to kids' development. But when it is, when we think more about how to shape the environment in our classrooms and in our schools, there's a whole lot that we can do to make those kids feel more of a sense of connection, to put them in environments where they can develop the sort of self-regulatory skills and habits that they haven't developed in their early years. And so to my mind, we need to kind of keep both of these ideas in our minds at the same time. Both that the idea that early childhood is probably our most effective and efficient time to intervene, and we need to do a whole lot more there. But also that if we don't, there is still a whole lot that we can do in later childhood.
This might be a good time for you to talk, if you would, about this Educare program. Talking about self-regulation, and they have this sort of, what is it, a bi-directional model. Would you talk about Educare? Because that seems important at this point.
Sure. So Educare is this program that exists in a number of different states. I think there are 27 centers around the country. And it's sort of it's like the best possible early childhood program out there. It starts as early as 6 weeks. It serves only low-income families, usually really low-income families who need lots of help and support. And it provides environments for children up through the beginning of kindergarten that are both stimulating sort of intellectually, especially in the later years for you know, 4 and 5 year olds, but are also warm and supportive and caring, and so provide that sort of serve and return nurturing and connection, the sort of secure attachment that researchers have shown is so important for kids. Even if they're living in the kind of unstable and sometimes chaotic environments that are true for so many poor kids, so for many hours a day they're in these really supportive environments, and it has this, as you can imagine, given the research, it has this profound effect on how well kids do and how prepared they are on the first day of kindergarten.
It was interesting you mentioned it costs about $20,000 a year, which is, you say, it's about what I guess an average state. I'm not sure where Utah fits in that, though that would be interesting. About $20,000 is about what a year of a high school in a fairly affluent suburb is. Mm-hmm. Right, something like that?
Yeah. That's right. And I think, you know, when you say $20,000, it sounds like a lot of money to be spent on a baby or on an infant or, you know, a four-year-old. But there's a whole case to be made for why that's a really good investment. Yeah. Some of it is, yeah, it's just this is what we spend on kids when they're older, but it's much more effective to spend it on a one-year-old than on a 16-year-old, which is not to say we shouldn't also be spending it on a 16-year-old, right. But just, you know, this is where we're going to get the most bang for our buck. It's also one of the things that I find interesting about Educare's funding is that they actually they do rely on philanthropic support, but not much. They're actually able to very inventively use existing streams and combine existing streams of support that are available to low-income parents, everything from universal pre-K dollars in some states to temporary aid for needy families to childcare grants, and sort of bundle those together, all of the things that their very needy families are eligible for, and then they only need a bit of philanthropy to make up the additional amount. And what that says to me is that, you know, we are spending lots of money in these high poverty communities. We're just mostly spending it really ineffectively and inefficiently, and making parents, you know, really like jump through a ton of hoops and you know, have to constantly prove themselves in order to be eligible for these programs. But if we just took those same resources and spent them in a more organized and efficient and well thought through fashion, we could, instead of having kind of chaotic funding streams, we could have something like Educare for, you know, not the few thousand kids who are currently in Educare programs around the country, but for many thousands, many hundreds of thousands of them.
Paul Tuff is with us. His book is Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Paul Tough. We're talking about his latest book, Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. What did you learn about discipline? One of those methods that you mentioned has been tried a lot and a lot of people are for is zero tolerance. You know, they figure it really solves the issue of the others who are being distracted by the person who's causing the problem. But you say those programs don't seem to work and, in fact, they can backfire.
Absolutely. So I think we're in the middle of kind of a sea change of thinking about school discipline in the country right now. Maybe the sea change isn't happening quite as quickly as I and others might want. But I don't think I'm alone in calling into question the kind of discipline practices that started in the zero tolerance era in the 80s and 90s, where the main tool that was used to discipline unruly students were out of school suspensions. The thought was, just get kids out of the building if they're misbehaving, and that'll not only improve their experience through, you know, the basics of negative reinforcement, it'll help them behave better, but it will also allow those kids who remain in the classroom to focus and concentrate more. And there is all kinds of research that suggests that this doesn't work. I mean, the first thing that I think a lot of people point out about suspension policy is that it focuses on certain demographics. So African American kids are suspended much more than other kids. Boys are suspended much more than girls. But there's a study I talk about from Chicago that looks even more finely at the data and shows that kids who are living in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, about one in four of them each year gets an out of school suspension in Chicago. Kids who've experienced abuse and neglect. Again, about one in four of them, much higher than the national average or even the Chicago average. And so I think that's for all the reasons we've been talking about, the effect of stress and what it does to a kid's fight or flight response. It makes it much more likely that they're going to misbehave in class. And so the new approaches are not, they're not saying like, well, let's just forget all about bad behavior and ignore it and tolerate anything. But it's saying like there are many other tools that teachers and educators and administrators have to create a climate in the school that leads to better behavior or that makes kids feel more connected and motivated and thus makes them behave better. And one of the studies I think that is most effective in making the case against the heavy reliance on suspension is this study in Kentucky that looked at the kids who weren't suspended and found that, in contrast to the theory that the rest of the kids are going to do better once you start kicking out the bad seeds, actually if you're in a classroom where lots of kids are being suspended, you do worse than kids in another classroom. And I think what's going on is that there's something about that kind of contentious, threatening atmosphere that goes along with a teacher doing a lot of suspending that makes it just hard to concentrate even when those kids are not in the classroom. And that in other classrooms where teachers are taking another approach and finding ways to deal with those kids who are having trouble regulating their behavior in more productive and constructive ways, that creates a climate that is much more conducive, not just for those kids, but for every kid in the classroom to learn.
That's a pretty good segue into incentives, which you write about in the book. And you see these programs at different school districts, motivating kids to read by having by giving them, paying them money, these financial incentives and these gifts and these programs. Mm-hmm. What you found is that those sorts of things, money doesn't really work that well as an incentive for kids.
Yeah, so there's this this great economist at Harvard University named Roland Fryer, who has made it his business to try to figure out, using all of the tools of economics, the kind of rigorous study of that economists use, to measure what helps kids, especially kids in adversity, to succeed. And so I think a lot of economists, it's sort of part of the basic economist mindset, is that humans respond to incentives and disincentives. And so he tested out in many over the past decade, he's tested out in many different cities at the cost of many tens of millions of dollars, many different incentive schemes that pay kids to read more books, that pay teachers to go to PTA meetings, that pay teachers to improve their students' success. And despite the fact that I think that he started off very optimistic about this approach, he's been very honest about what the result is, and the result is nothing. And none of these studies has produced a positive result. And so when you talk to psychologists about this study, they're like, I really wish these economists would come talk to us before they spend these tens of millions of dollars, because I think this is something that most psychologists know intuitively, that yes, in certain small ways, incentives and disincentives, the behaviorist approach does work. It can change our behavior in the short term in minor league ways. But if we want to really get kids motivated on the level that encourages them to succeed at school, and especially kids who are coming into school with all of the kind of neurobiological adaptations that come along with growing up in adversity, they need a very different set of motivational techniques. They need an environment that makes them feel connected and competent and with a certain amount of independence, and something that is relying heavily on positive and negative reinforcement, on that sort of behaviorist approach. It doesn't create any of those feelings in kids, and so as a result, they're not motivated.
Mm. There's a section in the book I wanted to ask you about where you sort of make this there's this comparison between a math teacher or math teachers in Japan and math teachers in America. And the method in Japan is interesting. The idea of letting them figure it out, getting it wrong, and when they do, there's a conversation about how they got it wrong. And there's a difference between the way, it seems like, in this particular case you write about, and the way Americans go about it. Would you talk about that difference?
Sure. So if I can, I just wanted to take one step back to say, like, so after all of this research about, you know, stress and discipline and what's going on in the classroom, one of the things that I came to believe as well is that a big toolbox for helping kids do better in this non-cognitive dimension involves challenge. Yeah. Involves the kind of work that they do, is not sort of like the mushy connectedness belonging stuff, but that kids feel motivated when they feel like I'm actually able to get better at something. And there's this whole other set of research that the Japanese study was a part of that suggests that there are some essential elements of American pedagogy, the way we teach math, for instance, that are anti-challenge. You know, like we are good at giving kids a ton of homework and giving them, you know, a big raft of worksheets to take home. We're not good at making mathematics or anything else challenging in kind of a deep way. And so this comparison of American and Japanese pedagogical techniques when it comes to eighth grade math, I think, is really informative. And the big difference is all about challenge. So American math teachers will say, here's the new rule, you know, finding a least common denominator, here's the rule, I'm going to write that on my overhead, then I'm going to show you two examples that are very similar, and then you do 10 examples that are very similar to that. I don't want you to, you know, I want you to feel confident that you're able to do it, so we're going to make them all almost exactly the same, and then we're going to give you homework, and you're going to do more of them at home. Whereas in Japan, what the teacher will do is say, okay, today's problem is, you know, 1/2 + 3/5. Now you just go figure it out. And, you know, no one's taught these kids how to find a least common denominator. Yeah. And so they, like, have no idea what to do. And so they do it wrong, and they sometimes work in groups, and they compare theories. And then the whole class starts talking about, well, I think this might be the answer. Well, here's why I think this might be the answer. And most of what they're saying is totally wrong.
Right.
but that experience of, like, acting like a mathematician, of, like, actually, you know, trying to trying to work it through. That's really profound for kids. And and I think it's also true that it's uncomfortable. It can be painful. It puts pressure and challenge on kids. But what the research from Japan and lots of other places suggests is that it not only is a better way to learn math, but it also tends to help kids develop in this non-cognitive realm, because mm-hmm. they see challenge and failure as something that they don't need to be afraid of, that it is a moment where they're learning and getting better at something, and they come to believe in their own ability to, you know, make a case with their peers, to understand something that seems impossible. And all of those experiences are just as important as the math. It means when they go to high school or go to college and are faced with some challenge that seems impossible, they're going to have the experience of, oh yeah, I've done that before. I've had something that seemed impossible and I figured it out.
Toward the end of the book, you mention some of the changes that you think are going to be necessary in order to adopt some of these ideas. But you say for right now, a lot of the ideas are still pretty much outside of the mainstream. Why do you think that is? It just we're slow adapters in a system like American education?
It's a great question. I think a few things. I mean, I think most of this research is not well known from what we were just talking about in terms of the different kinds of math pedagogies, all the way back to the neurobiology and the effect of stress and adversity on kids' development. A lot of that is pretty new science and not very well known. So I think there's a process of these ideas spreading into the culture. But I also think that there is a way that where this pushes us as a society or as individual, you know, teachers or even parents is kind of challenging. You know, if the message is like for parents, like what you need to do in order to help your kids develop is not just, you know, give them an iPhone and let them sit in the corner and think they're learning by going through their flashcards, but what they need is this serve and return interaction, this face-to-face interaction with you. I can say as a parent of a one-year-old, it's kind of boring sometimes doing serve and return interaction. Even if it's really exciting for the babies, it's kind of boring for the parent. And yet, you know, this research is pushing us in that direction. And similarly for teachers, it's easier, especially when you've got unruly kids, to suspend them if they're acting up. It's easier to give them, you know, lots of repetitive homework than to find ways of making, you know, math class more challenging and interesting. So despite all of that sort of pessimistic stuff that I just said, what I find some encouragement from is, you know, that Russian study that we talked about, yeah. That it seemed easier not to interact with those babies for those Russian orphanage workers. But when they got the kind of support that said, here, try this other method, they found it much more rewarding. And I think that's true for parents, and I think that's true for teachers as well, that when we can take these steps, even if they're a little harder, that push us in the direction of more connection, developing kids better in this non-cognitive realm, it's better for us as the adults around them as well.
That's Paul Tough. His book is Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. Joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Paul, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.